This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thanks very much indeed. I was actually just reminded Mike's story of the aircraft carrier with no aircraft. But some of you may remember that Yes Minister episode about the hospital with no patients. And the hospital with no patients had, of course, no waiting lists. It had the lowest procurement budget of all time. It had absolutely no hospital-acquired infection. It was an absolute triumph for ministers. Anyway, what I'd like to talk to you a little bit about today, I think you've been almost, if I can put it that way, with the Secretary of State in sort of outer space, looking at the whole topography of the world. I think Mike has brought you down to earth a bit, and probably a helicopter view of healthcare at home and the relationship with other services. I'm going to take you right down to the ground. It's not a place that I'm usually sitting, because certainly for 6 years here at the fund, we were more helicopter view than we were. Though actually, in the last couple of years I was here, we launched a program called first of all, we did quite a lot of work on end of life care, which was more on the ground, and we also started this program Point of Care, which was both the point of care but also looked at the interaction between professionals and patients. And ultimately, of course, without contact between professionals and patients, everything we're talking about is absolutely nothing. So all these views are perfectly valid, and they have a validity in themselves. But I think sometimes those of us who traditionally have been at either, dare I say, a helicopter view or space view, sometimes forget about what it really means in terms of the interaction between professionals and patients, which ultimately is the only thing that matters, providing you've arranged that correct contact in the first place. So I want to talk a little bit this morning about some relatively new guidance that we produced earlier this year for doctors who are dealing with patients at the end of life. And like quite a lot of our guidance, a lot of it could apply in various forms to other professions as well, though it does need careful interpretation in terms of the responsibilities of individual professionals. So what I want to do is just give you a brief overview of the context of this guidance and what GMC guidance actually means, talk a little bit about the new guidance that we produced for end-of-life treatment and care, why we needed to review the existing guidance, how we develop our guidance, which is very important in terms of its validity. In other words, it isn't Neil going off to an office and just writing out what he thinks might be a nice idea for doctors to do. What's new and different, and there is quite a bit that's new and different about this guidance. And then lastly, perhaps posing some questions as much as answers about the real importance of trying to make guidance relevant to practice. Because we know that doctors who read our guidance really think it's very good. We know that it has real traction with patient groups and all that kind of stuff. But the real thing is, what do you do if you're a recently qualified doctor at 2 a.m, you're on your own and you're in a hospital ward and you're faced with these kind of situations, and actually diving in and saying, oh, I know, I'll have a look at this book produced by GMC, is not so great. So it's about making it alive, making it accessible, using new technology, I think, as well, and really making it relevant to people in their day-to-day practice. That's important. Just a brief word about the General Medical Council. I suppose we're best known because of newspaper reports and everything else for striking doctors off, I think is probably the usual thing. There are, at the moment, I think something like 235,000 doctors on our register, and in 2009, 68 doctors were struck off. So although that is an important part of what we do in terms of fitness to practice, it isn't actually the basis of what we're about. What we're actually about is setting standards. We're a standard-setting organisation, and we produce the general standards and ethics, the professional behaviour that we for the profession. We also are responsible for standards and for the outcomes in terms of the curriculum for the entire process of medical education, from the day the doctor walks into the medical school through any postgraduate training they may go through. That is all regulated by us, and their continuing professional development as well. We obviously control the exit and entrance, just like the Nursing and Midwifery Council or any of these regulators, the entry and exit into the profession. And then we do have fitness to practice for doctors whose fitness to practice may be impaired, and have processes for dealing with that. But fundamentally, we see ourselves as a standard-setting organisation and having a constant dialogue with the profession, and indeed with patients and the public, and indeed with other professions, about what is expected of doctors and the standards of practice that society expects from them. As part of that, the Medical Act in 1983, as amended, gives us power to give advice to the profession on standards of professional conduct, professional performance, and on medical ethics as the council thinks fit. And this, therefore, in a sense, is saying this is guidance, but it is guidance which has got teeth attached to it, as it were. And our core guidance document is Good Medical Practice. Just give me a minute, how many people here are aware of Good Medical Practice as a document? About half. Okay. I mean, it's interesting. And again, there are sorts of equivalents in other I hope that was all the doctors in the room. Never know. We ran a thing actually at the GMC a few weeks ago where I was trying to get different parts of the organisation to understand different parts, and they had a marketplace, and all the staff got very imaginative about it, and the people at the standards lot had this map of the world, and you had to guess which countries had adopted good medical practice. And this document has been adopted by, I think it's 27 countries in the world. It's been adopted in every country in the world, and actually many more than that, in the sense of people adapting it. Some of these are whole-scale adaptions, which, you know, plagiarism is the greatest form of flattery. Actually, of course, you want people to develop their own guidance and for it to be culturally specific rather than just say ours is the greatest thing ever. But certainly in countries like New Zealand and so on, they have adapted it a bit, but actually they've taken the work that's been done here, which is hugely flattering. And then from Good Medical Practice, there are all sorts of other bits of guidance that follow from that. Areas such as doctors acting as expert witnesses, raising concerns, good practice in research, stuff on confidentiality and the like. And then we have other bits of guidance that refer to looking after children, and the one I'm going to talk about today, about treatment and care towards the end of life. What our guidance is, it's broad principles of good practice. It applies in most cases, it applies to all registered doctors. It's based on established ethical principles, and it's consistent with current UK law. So I'm not going to be talking about assisted suicide because it's not legal, and it's not part of our guidance. And the idea is that the guidance represents common ground between the profession, the public, and people who provide services through involving all these groups, as it were, as we develop the guidance, putting it out to consultation, having a lot of conversations about how it's put together. And anybody who's read any of this kind of stuff before, the one thing I would say as a relative newcomer to this is it's all deceptively simple. When you read it, it just looks like common sense. But actually, there's an awful lot of thought and effort goes into the wording of it and making sure that it is robust in practice. And importantly, it's not a rule book. This is not... Doctors still have to exercise their judgment. In fact, the reason why we pay all professionals, but especially doctors, considerable sums of money is that we expect them to work in a world of uncertainty and to exercise their judgment in applying in individual cases. So the primary purpose is to advise doctors, but it also, we hope, tells patients, public, others who are providing service what's expected of doctors. It absolutely informs the medical curriculum. I mentioned that we regulate both undergraduate and postgraduate medical education, and of course it is taught in undergraduate courses. And it also provides a benchmark to consider doctors' fitness to practice when complaints are made to the GMC. It is used for that, but that's an important role. But its primary purpose, is not to hit doctors over the head when they haven't done it, but to help inform their practice and to guide them in that practice. We hope that it'll form the framework for the NHS and other appraisal systems when we begin the revalidation of doctors, which we believe will be starting in late 2012. So, I want to talk just a little bit more in detail then about this document, treatment and care towards the end of life, and just touch on some of the principles behind it. I think the first thing to say is that why we started to do this, because we had an earlier version, as it were, in 2002. And the short answer is a lot had happened in that time. The Mental Capacity Act arrived in 2005. We've quite a lot of requests from doctors to clarify issues in some areas of the guidance, particularly difficult areas like cardiopulmonary resuscitation and also artificial hydration and nutrition. There obviously had been quite a lot of work in England through the development of the national guidance there, but also work in Scotland as well, and I think ongoing public concern about the standards of end-of-life care, and the fact that end-of-life care quite often seemed to fall short of what we hoped and believed would be achieved, in spite of the really amazing achievements, both in this country and recognised around the world, of the hospice movement in this country. So we wanted to develop new guidance. It took us 2 years to do this. We had an external working group which was represented by other professions, by doctors themselves, by ethicists, by patient groups and all the people you'd expect, chaired by Lady Eames, a range of perspectives, including all that lot. And then once we produced guidance, we then went out and tried it out on lots of people and so forth. I'll run through this fairly quickly, but that basically says, yes, we talked to an awful lot of people about it, including a Mumsnet survey of parents, where we got more than 600 responses. And what we learned from the consultation, I think, that was the first round of this, that we needed more on the role of families and carers, so that's quite built in, strong importance of good communication, advanced care planning and effective team working. All this stuff's fairly meat and drink, I guess, to most people in this room. Some of our terminology, not easy, actually, getting the terminology right, because people have very strong views about what terms you use for what things. And also, frankly, trying to reconcile the four jurisdictions of the UK, because, again, Scotland uses certain words to describe things that are different as well. Wanted more on organ donation, more advice on dealing with very young babies, and more clarity about the principles and decisions around areas like artificial nutrition and CPR. The guidance provides an ethical framework to help doctors provide good care. It certainly recognises that decisions about end-of-life treatment are or can be clinically complex and emotionally difficult for everyone involved, for all the professionals involved, for carers, for family members, and of course for the individual patient. And the guidance explores how you reach decisions involving patients, family, carers, legal proxies if you're needing them if the patient doesn't have capacity, as well as the health and social care teams. But it doesn't, I mentioned this point about the law, it doesn't include advice on assisted suicide or euthanasia, because we expect doctors to work within UK law, and currently that is the UK law that those things are illegal. The issues covered include equality and human rights. There is a presumption in the guidance in favour of prolonging life. When I say a presumption in favour, it doesn't mean in absolutely all cases that, of course, that is the right thing to do. It covers advanced care planning, advanced requests or refusals of treatment, organ donation, and some of these other issues. Three overriding key principles, I think, behind all this. First of all, as I've said, must start with a presumption in favour of life, but not irrespective of the consequences of prolonging life for the patient or for the patient's views. And the issue about how you play in patient views is important, and there are different circumstances how their views are taken into account. Patients who are approaching the end of life must be given the same quality of care as all other patients. I think we all in this room would endorse that. And when patients can't decide for themselves, decisions must be based on whether the treatment would be of overall benefit to the patient. And that concept of overall benefit is explored within the guidance. There are two decision-making models differentiated between two categories of patient. Where the patient has capacity to decide, there are things that you need to think about, and where the patient lacks capacity to decide, there are a different set of things to think about. And they set out, these two decision-making models, how you reach a decision in each of these cases. And it is designed to be useful to doctors who need a quick overview of both their ethical and their legal responsibilities in these areas. So let me just give you an example in terms of advanced care planning. Again, people, when we went out to consultation, was very keen that we should do more on this. First of all, the emphasis and saying to doctors the importance of early and sensitive discussion and planning with patients, if you can do it, can help avoid uncertainty and disagreement when the patient is no longer able to make their wishes known. That advanced care planning ensures good communication and coordination across teams, and so that patients get the care they want where and when they need it. There's quite a lot of emphasis, though, on always being where the patient is at. In other words, you should not be ramming things down a patient because you've got to advance care plan. And it goes back to some of the discussion you were having earlier about home or what sort of death you want and so on. I think it is always important, and I hope the guidance reflects that, the fact that human beings are different, they're in different places at different times, and actually the art of the professional is having judgment about where that patient is at and where they want to be at that particular time. And this reflects this as well, that it's not a one-off process. It needs to be reviewed as the patient's situation or indeed their wishes change. When we come on to advanced requests and refusals, and this is the point. Some patients want to retain as much control as possible towards the end of their lives and may wish either to request or refuse a particular treatment. The difference here, again, between refusal and request, and this runs through the guidance, really irrespective of the situation that you're in. In advance, if a patient in advance wants to refuse treatment, if it's valid and it's applicable, it's binding, it's legal. You have to follow what that patient says. And that applies whether it's advanced or not advanced, quite frankly. If the patient is saying, I don't want this treatment. Again, whether advanced or not advanced, if a patient says, I want this treatment, it's slightly less strong, if I can put it that way, because you can't, as a patient, demand any treatment and require that the doctor gives you that treatment. You don't have that absolute right. I want to have this treatment and I demand it. But in all these circumstances, the patient's opinion must weigh strongly on the decision that the doctor makes. So the doctor may not think it's in your overall best interest, but you really want this thing to happen, then again, the patient's view absolutely must be taken into account in those circumstances. But you're not legally bound to give that treatment. And here it's shown in terms of advance requests, but as I say, it applies whether it's advance or not. Advance requests are not legally binding in the same way as refusals may be, but again, they should carry weight in future decision-making about the balances of benefits, burdens, and risks. And clearly, in terms of advance requests, it's much more difficult because the patient isn't able to, if they don't have capacity, they can't comment on the exact situation that they're in at that particular moment. Organ donation, likewise, again, there was quite a strong after the first, when we put out the first iteration of this, people came back wanting more, I think, about advice on discussing organ donation. And again, I think it is this balance between not wanting to ram things at people, but making sure you're at where they're at and giving them the opportunity. So creating opportunities for patients who want to discuss what should happen after their death, as wider as advanced care planning. And again, in appropriate cases, sensitively discussing the issue with the family, focusing on whether the patient had expressed views or wishes about donation before their death. Again, the same principles really apply in relation to clinically assisted nutrition and hydration and cardiopulmonary resuscitation. Again, the principle, clinically assisted nutrition is regarded as treatment legally, so it is just in that sense like another treatment. These were some of the most difficult decisions, I think, that in the consultation that we dealt with, and certainly the most difficult decisions for clinicians, because of obviously the importance that many attach to them. The principles for decision making are the same as the other treatments that I've described. In other words, there's a difference between request and refusal. Refusal is pretty absolute. Request is slightly more complicated, but patients' views absolutely to the fore. And the guidance in relation to clinically assisted nutrition contains some extra safeguards, like seeking a second opinion at certain points in the process. And when a patient requests clinically assisted nutrition or in advance request or asks for CPR, and the benefits and the burdens are finally balanced, again, the patient's request that it should really be, in most cases, will be the deciding factor. So finally, I just want to make the point about how do we kind of make this stuff real. We've got quite a lot of work we're doing in terms of online to make things interactive, to make it more fun, if I can use that term, to help doctors in their decision making, to put them in situations and ask them how they would deal with that, using vignettes to try and bring this stuff alive, and using case studies to illustrate some of these really difficult decisions around artificial nutrition, hydration, and CPR. The easiest way is not to listen to me, but go online and have a look at it, because it's all there. And any ideas on how we can make this stuff come alive is really important, I think, in terms of making it in day-to-day practice something that is imbued in people's minds. For specialists, they should be there anyway. But of course, lots of people who deal with people near or at the end of life are not specialists. They've got 1,001 other pressures. Their specialism may be in some other area or in none. And this sort of guidance is important, and it is important that it becomes absolutely integral to practice if we're going to aspire on the ground level, as well as the helicopter, and as well as up in space, to get this thing right and improve the quality of care for people at the end of life. Thanks very much.